another 2 centimeters just last week. So they're happy about that. That's called the heat flow physical property package. They call it HP3, you know, HP cubed. Although I don't think it's cubed, it's just that they use the word physical property package because it all starts with letter P. And they call it that, HP3. Well, it's about, what, 14-inch long mold with a, you know, an internal hammer with a spring on it and a motor and a cam, and it keeps turning and trying to get its way into the surface. And it only went a little bit initially, and they thought maybe it hit a rock. And they've been working on this since it landed. And, you know, they're trying to figure out what the problem is. Now they think it's the soft sand, and they've worked around it. They push some sand back with the scoop on them on insight, and then push down with the scoop to create some friction around the body of this thing. And sure enough, it went down 2 centimeters. So now, within another week or so, they're going to try again and see if they can get this thing to go down. It's eventually they want to get it to go down like 3 meters. Back to you, Ryan.
Very good, Paul. Yeah, I remember vaguely reading good news about it and something about spot on, but I didn't remember it enough. Thanks for reminding me and the rest of us. And that's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I just want to repeat myself one last time. If you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any space questions for Paul, if you have any questions, comments for me, just send them to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All of these stories, they'll have links to them. You can look at the YouTube about how mirrors rotate images, apparently, and some other good YouTubes and articles that I've come across lately, and that's at roy.ac2gs.com. So thanks to everyone. Hopefully next week I will be back with a whole bunch of stories, and I'll figure out yet another puzzle. So thanks to Paul, and thanks to Dick for giving me this opportunity. I'll pass it over to Dick so he can pass it over to Paul.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. WS2N, Paul, what's going on in the world of space?
Okay, well, we hit on one topic already, the InSight mission. And Roy says it came out of conjunction with, you know, that's where Mars is, like, behind the sun. And they have to shut down operations for a couple of weeks while that happens. So not only InSight, but all the planetary vehicles, the ones that are driving on the surface. In this case, there's only one that's survived so far. That's Curiosity. The other ones are not working anymore. But you have all the orbital ones. You have a half a dozen orbital spacecraft going around Mars that also go into a fail-safe type of mode. Why they pass that? That conjunction. Now they popped out on the other side, so now they're good to go. So hopefully they'll get that heat probe all the way down. There was three main instruments on board, and one was the seismometer, and they had six seismometers in one inside this. Thing that they put on the surface, and then they covered it up with this gadget to make sure no little breeze affected it. They wanted to be able to look for Mars quakes, and it's already found some. And with that, they could also, you know, they could do some deduction and figure out what the interior of Mars is like. And that's why they call it InSight. And the idea is to look inside the planet. And the other main one is this probe that we just talked about, that it's supposed to hammer its way 15 feet into the ground, and that, of course, failed, and it looks like it's on the way to becoming a success. They believe now that it is not a rock, otherwise it would have never even gone that 2 centimeters. It's gone, I think it went 10 centimeters, you know, it went down around 4 inches initially, then stopped. And why did it stop? Because it didn't have enough friction to, you know, support on the outside, and it actually started, you know, rotating, creating like a cone, and that's bad. Once that starts happening, it doesn't have enough friction behind it to sustain itself every time it happens. So hopefully the inside people will be able to have a successful mission. I mean, it's battery powered. It's going to sit there for, you know, it's a planned 2-year mission, but they'll probably let it go 2 years, 4 years. They'll just let it keep going as long as it keeps running. Let me drop it. So, okay, but the main story this week was the EVA, the spacewalk done by the two women, Christina Cook and Jessica Meir. They were scheduled actually to go out tomorrow on the 21st. I talked about that last week, and that was the idea was to go out and continue to reinstall or install new batteries, take out old batteries and put in the new batteries. For anybody that isn't listening, you know, hasn't been listening to the net, there's an overall project on the space station. You know, it's getting old. It's been up there since like 2000. And all these big batteries outside the station, and they're big. Each one weighs around 400 pounds. There's 48 of them all across the station, along the truss segments. Everywhere you have solar panels coming down where it meets the truss, you have these batteries. And there's four groupings of them, four main solar cells, solar panels, and then there's four main battery areas. And each time they do this, and they've done it two times in the last couple of years, they go out and change out. They take 12 batteries out and put 6 in, taking out nickel hydrogen batteries and putting in new lithium ion batteries. But like I said, there's a lot of mass, around 400 pounds. So, you know, when you take an astronaut and they have a spacesuit weighing around 300 pounds plus themselves, you know, you're looking at 350 plus, you know, 400 pound thing. You have a lot of mass moving in one direction when they're grabbing you. It's like trying to stop 700 pounds from going forward. So they have to move very slow. The robotic arm doesn't have the capability as it did for the batteries that are more inboard to grab a hold of them and help the astronauts, because so far at the end, in this case, they call it the P6 or Port 6 location, all the way at the end of the space station. The space station is like 356 feet long. So it has to go all the way out to the end, and the robotic arm can help a little bit, but not as much as they need. So instead of doing 2 spacewalks to change out all these batteries, it's taking 5 spacewalks. So they went through 2 spacewalks already, and then they were going to do a third, and Christina Cook and Jessica Meir were going to go out tomorrow. And, you know, they shimmy out on the truss section. They have tethers on. And the robotic arm will basically hold batteries in front of them. They'll grab a hold of it and then pass it off to the one astronaut and then another one and so forth all the way down the line. That's the system. But they had to stop that. Why'd they have to stop that? Because the BCD unit failed. A battery charged discharge unit. Now, you know, it sounds like, well, what is it, just a little box or something? It's another big suitcase, bigger than a suitcase type box that contains the battery charge discharge unit, which involves not only the electronics, but it's got cooling units inside, you know, to keep the components cool. So it's a big thing. It weighs around 240 pounds. And it had failed. There's There's a series of these things all over the space station, just like this. There's 48 big batteries on the whole station. There's 24 of these battery charge discharge units that have to be changed out. That don't have to be changed out, but when they break, they have to be changed out. And they only have three spares on station. And they need one of them, and that's what they did on Friday. So if you saw the news, it was on radio stations, it was on TV, and they talked about these two women that went outside the space station. That's what they're doing. I'm very, very interested in finding what is inside the battery charge discharge unit. If I can see the electronic, you know, I know there's not tubes. I know there's, you know, but they don't tell you what's in there. And I searched the internet left and right, cannot find a diagram of what's inside. I can see the box. I can see how it's attached, but you can't see it inside. It's not like the batteries that they're replacing. They're called nickel hydrogen batteries. That I could find. I could find out, tell you how many cells are in each battery. You know, you could even see the connections, you know, the series and parallel connections that are made inside the nickel hydrogen batteries. That's what they're called, nickel hydrogen. They're not nickel metal hydride batteries that we're used to. They're actually nickel hydrogen batteries. And there's 38 of them inside each box. And they're taking them out and disposing of them. And replacing it, you know, you take two of them out and replace it with one lithium ion battery. Well, this battery charge discharge unit, they successfully went on the spacewalk. And it was a long spacewalk. They finished actually early, so they got some get-ahead tasks that were done. But, turned out to be a 7 hour and 17 minute spacewalk, which is pretty long, especially for Jessica Meir. She was the first time out for her. Christina Cook was the fourth time out, so she's already plenty of experience. But 7 hours and 17 minutes for the spacewalk.
Question.
Okay, and her question, and by the way, everything was successful. Before they even came in, they got the word from Houston that the new system is working, the new battery charge discharge unit is working. Yeah, question, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. KC1SAM. The DC-DC unit, nickel hydrogen batteries and lithium-ion batteries, require very different charging rates. Is that thing designed to handle the charge, the different types of batteries like that? Could that have burnt the unit out?
Well, apparently, you know, maybe they have to do some change in the software. I don't know. I haven't seen the inside of the unit yet. But I know they've been doing this for a couple of years now, and they haven't changed any of these units. I think they might have had trouble with one in the past. I know they had trouble with one of the new lithium batteries. They did have to pull one of them out, put back two of the old ones not so long ago. But I don't know about these regulating type systems that the 24 on station and fail. What they have to do to accommodate. I know they have a jumper system that's involved. To you're taking two out and you're putting one in. There's another jumper system. It's pretty large. Looks like about the same size of an old battery. But they have to, it's much thinner. They plug that in every time they do it, too. So what's involved there, I don't know. By the way, your question last week about the voltages, I said 120 volts, which is true. What comes down on the solar panels are 160 volts, give or take. And it goes into these DC converters. This is all on that same integrated board that has all these BCU units are located, as well as the batteries. You see the DC converters, they're converting 160 down to 120 DC. So if you need AC, I mean, that doesn't happen until you get into, until you actually get into the ISS itself. They don't have, like, outlets. You know, like, you know, you can't take, like, your 120-volt shaver and plug it in, you know. Their outlets are very specialized. They don't want plugs just plugged in case you accidentally pull it out. One end, you know, one end might go flying all over the place. They don't want that. You're hitting something important. So they have these screw connectors. You know, instead of calling it an outlet, you know, they call it a utility outlet panel. It looks like a panel. And it's got connectors that you screw your device. That's especially, you know, especially made for going to the space station. The screw connector, you know, it looks like a big TL-259 connector. You screw that in, and this way, there's no way in the world that accidentally popping out of the connection. It's delivering you 120 volt DC, so whatever happens, you know, wherever that leads to, whatever you're driving it with, that would have the, have to, again, step it down if you're using something. We need to have an AC. We need it for at least that. Drop it. And then you talked about the before, right? They have on everything. And just like the shuttle, when the shuttle docks with it, got, you know, as the years went on, they wanted the shuttle to have longer flights. But, cutting back, but that's the space. And they would pick up the power from the international space. But initially it was 160 volts coming down the solar panel. The reason for that is for these panels, the higher the voltage, of course, you could use less, you know, instead of wire.
Well,
why do they keep going? Why not 200 or 400? But, you know, once you get past the 160, 170 point, they worry about plasma arc over, you know, some kind of plasma effect. They don't need that. They know going up to 160 was safe. But the spacewalk is successful. And now they're going to make a schedule for remaining EVAs.
Paul?
Starting last month, three or four months, they had 10 planned NASA EVAs and one Russian EVA. So really a total of 11. But you have these four people, two guys, two women, that are rotating back and forth doing the first five EVAs, which have to do with changing out all these batteries. You know, and once that's all done, they're going to have 75% of all these batteries replaced. They've already done 50% over the last couple of years. So now, next year, I think the end of next year, they're going to send up another cargo vehicle with another six lithium-ion batteries.
Paul, can you hear me? Your signal has been getting weak periodically, and you've been completely fading out. Just what you're coming back now, but you were very weak and fading out there for a while. Okay, Paul, C2LAW.
All right, I'm going to turn the antenna. Yeah, bye. Okay, let's see if this works. Okay. Not there yet. Stand by. This is WS2N. I copy things.
Yeah, I think you're going through the eastern input now, and you're sounding quite a bit better, Paul.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, this should be a lot better.
Okay, let's hope that the propagation doesn't change again. Sounding good.
Yeah, this is my plan B. I still don't have a 440 capability. I can receive, but transmit on 7780. I should do something about that. Okay, so that's the deal on the spacewalk. And then there's 75 more spacewalks right after these are complete. I guess, with this one, I guess it's going to be 11 spacewalks by the Americans, plus the one by the Russians, so maybe that'll be a total of 12. And so, nevertheless, once they complete these batteries, my guess is three more spacewalks. They're going to have five more to work on the alpha magnetic spectrometer. So we'll talk about that when that comes up. I talked about it a little bit last week before. And that thing is another meant to be serviced. It was so successful. They planned on a couple of years. Now they want the thing to run forever. So they're going to change out all the pumps, the cooling pumps. We change out. They're only working on one, and that's intermittent. They got problems with that. All the photons, electrons, positrons, flying through the going here to the space station. And that's another form of astronomy that you were talking about. All these different things that they're looking at. They're using this, not really a telescope, but it's the same idea. It's looking at subatomic particles in space and where they're coming from and what kind they are. And basically, one of the purposes is to study dark matter and dark energy.
This signal is getting noisy and weak also. I wonder, is it possible that as your amplifier heats up, it puts out less power?
Yeah. It could be. I really don't know. I'm going to go back and try the other one. The other one. Hope we'll try it. I know my radio was making noise before. Could be on its way out, but we don't know. It could be conditions too. How's the K2RIW WS2N?
Medium good right now, Paul. You think that's the best aiming of the antenna?
Yeah, it's pretty much where it was. Go a little further. How's that, sir?
A tiny bit worse. Go back.
Yeah, you never know. You'd think it wouldn't be that critical with a 10-element, vertically polarized, pushcraft antenna.
Yeah, there are bursts of noise coming through, both on your signal and mine. So I guess it could be conditions. The rainy conditions at the site, I think, is aggravating it.
Yeah, I heard the cracklies all on Roy's signal as well. Throughout the whole part of the science talk, but it's a pleasure to listen to them because it's a big difference. That you got rid of all those the dropout problems. That's all gone. So as far as I'm concerned, DFQ. That's close to a DFQ signal to me. I know it was noisy, crackly here and there, but that's probably what you're hearing on mine as well, sir.
And right now, things are very good, so please proceed.
Okay, very good. Yeah, you never know. So, okay, there's another mission that was launched by Russia. I mean, it was a satellite built by Northrop Grumman. It used to be Orbital ATK, but Northrop has taken over. And it's called the Mission Extension Vehicle. Geosynchronous orbit. They launched two satellites. They launched one communication satellite to geosynchronous orbit, and this one went for a ride, mission extension vehicle. And the plan for this thing was to, or is to, it hasn't done it yet, it's on its way, to eventually dock with the IS-901. Interstellar SAT, or IS, they call it, telecommunications satellite that's been up there like forever, the early 2000s, and it's still operating, still functional, but fuel is like almost gone. You need fuel to stay in geosynchronous orbit, move around a little here and there, and eventually it fails, and they always try to get around 15 years out of these geosynchronous satellites. And there's hundreds of these things that are in geosynchronous satellite orbits. This one is on its way out, and they need to, they wanted to save it. So they put together this MEV, the MEV, they actually call it MEV-1, the Mission Extension Vehicle. They launched it on a Proton rocket, and it probably will dock, I think, around December. Why does it take so long? Because it has a Hall effect ion rocket, you know, to move it. So eventually we'll get to that location, and it's got this probe that comes out, and it's going to get, you know, eventually take pictures. I know it's got infrared pictures. I'm assuming it has a camera on board. I know it's got a laser range finding gadget on board, but eventually it's going to get closer and closer to this debunked satellite, and it's going to come actually from behind it. It'll actually be looking down on Earth when it comes up to it, and it's going to send the probe into the exhaust. It's called the exhaust, you know, the bell cone of the Apogee motor. For moving the satellite, and it's going to grab a hold of that. It's going to pull itself in. It's got this locking mechanism. It's going to lock in three places, and it's going to grab a hold of this thing, and it'll be like one satellite. And from there, it's going to move it. In fact, it's going to change inclination, which is not an easy thing to do. It's going to change the inclination by 1 degree. Right now it's at 1 degree inclination. They want to change it to perfect 0 degree inclination, so it's going to be right on the equator. And they're going to move it over to, I think it's 27 degrees. I forgot what it is, 27 point something, but 27 degrees west location. So, you know, this is a perfectly good operating satellite. The whole panel's working, everything. They think they're going to be able to keep this thing operating for another 5 years. So at the end of 5 years, they'll be happy with it, and then eventually the goal is to replace that satellite. But they're going to gain another 5 years on this particular satellite. At that time, it's going to reignite the, you know, the new satellite. Mission Extension Vehicle will reignite its ball ion thruster and push it into the graveyard location. You know, where that is location. That location is when they go further into, you know, farther away in apogee or altitude. that's the graveyard, the yard location. You can leave the satellite there like for 1,000 years, and it won't come back to. There's not enough rarefied air to slow it down to deorbit it. So it's going to bring it there 5 years from now after doing another 5 years of work, leave it there, and it's going to go to get another satellite. They don't know which one yet, but eventually, you know, there's a whole bunch that might be, ready to have extended missions. And they could do this for the next 50 years. They'll go up to another satellite attached to another 15 years if they want. So far, it's successful. It got over the launch pad and it's on the way, but we don't know if it's going to work out until December. And I remember talking about this on this net many, many years ago when this was first being developed by Orbital ATK. Now it's called Northrop Grumman. And sure enough, they got it off the ground and it's in operation. As we speak. Any questions or comments on MEV 1? I think it's quite an accomplishment. But, there is another satellite or mission that's being planned 2 years from now. It's supposed to rescue Landsat number 7. They call it Landsat 7. And there's a mission that's actually going to, tap into the fueling system and actually refuel the satellite. And also, this is a much easier system what they have here. You attach to a satellite, have a rocket engine, in this case a Hall ion thruster, to move it into location. When you fire these ion thrusters, they can fire for years without it shutting off. And it's a terrific engine. Well proven, there's probably 100 satellites that have flown now with that system. I know of 60 that were just launched not too long ago, 60 satellites with Hall thrusters, and that's called the Starlink project by SpaceX. Elon Musk has launched 60 of those satellites, and he plans on launching a total 12,000 satellites, all with Hall thrusters. And I guess if that's not good enough, he's already applied to the government to not only launch those 12,000, now he wants to launch another 30,000 more, over 40,000 satellites. So he's getting carried away. I'm just amazed that he keeps getting these things approved. Right now, the new 30,000 are not approved. That's incredible. And how are they going to, look at these satellites and look at all the debris and stuff that's up there now? Well, there is a company called Leo Labs out of Silicon Valley. Put it into operation, they call it the Kiwi Space Radar. They just put it into operation on the South Island of New Zealand. And they plan on putting a couple of these things down. This looks like something you would do, skateboarding on. Long antenna. I don't know how long it is. Looks like it's a couple hundred feet, and it's got this, it's not round, it's circular. I should put it on Roy's website to see what I'm looking at. But this thing can track objects as small as 2 centimeters, which is really small. NORAD right now looks at every object that's 10 centimeters, roughly 4 inches, 4-inch block, like a CubeSat. They could track that. They're tracking, I think, some 10,000 not only satellites, but debris that's in orbit around the Earth. Well, this company is coming out with this other thing that could track all the way down to 2 centimeters. So they're going to add to that. Instead of, let's say, 15,000 pieces of junk flying around the Earth, company believes they could add to that to up to 250,000 objects they'll be able to look at. So we'll see how Leo Labs does. They got this one thing operating now that they want to open up a couple of more. But it looks like what they call a half pipe. If you watch the Olympics, that's what it looks like. So we'll see how this the radar system works. Any comments or questions on either Leo Labs or Top? Okay, nothing hurt. I hope I'm still getting out, but now we talk about geosynchronous satellite system. Right now I'm going to talk about this other one by the Japan Aerospace Exploration. It's called the Sumbam satellite. Sumbam satellite is, they spell it T-S-U-B-A-M-E. Tango Sierra Uniform Bravo Alpha Mike Echo satellite. That thing's been up there for 3 years. And the idea of it is, you know, it's an imaging satellite. Usually, you know, you fly like, you know, 300 miles up or something like that. And you look down with all kinds of fancy cameras and you can, you know, you can see what you're looking at. The resolution is, you know, a certain amount of meters or whatever it might be. If you can fly at a lower altitude, you got about 300 miles, you know, come down to 120 miles, you know, 150 miles even, and take pictures, you know, it's inverse square law. You know, you would need a camera that's you know, four times, you know, as weak as another camera, and you're going to get the same imagery. Or use the same camera, and you're going to get real fantastic imagery. So the question is, how do you stay at that altitude? There's rarefied atmosphere at 120 miles, 150 miles. This thing got down to 112 miles and stayed in orbit for months at a time. And no problem. And the way they did that is a haul thruster on board, constantly firing in a forward direction, keeping this thing as low as they at the end they went down to 112 miles. And then they posted imagery that pictures that it took compared to, you know, one that, you know, 300 miles and then another one at 100. I think this one was 125 miles. And there is a big difference between the pictures that they take. Let me drop it. Mitsubishi, you know, the electric corporation, puts this up there. Launched on an H2A rocket. The H2A and the H2B are the two main rockets that Japan launches there. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rockets. For instance, all those batteries that we talked about earlier in the six batteries that they're now replacing. You know, adding to the system. It was bought up by a HCV cargo vehicle launched by Japan, and that was launched on an H2B rocket. A rocket, basically. Dr. Roy was talking about earlier, you know, his orbit. So this H2A had put 3 years ago this particular spacecraft in orbit. And it's been flying in a very low orbit ever since, taking pictures. ion thrust system to keep it at that low altitude. That's pretty good accomplishment. And we'll probably do more of that. You might have photography satellites flying at that altitude. Any comments or questions? Okay, another rocket company I've talked very little about. It's called Firefly. And they've gone through different iterations of what their rocket will look like. And the idea is to launch maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 pounds into orbit. And they're going to be launching from American soil, American company. Right now they're building a launch in California. They launched their rocket system called the Alpha Rocket. So, can't be in their name. But they've just signed a deal with Aerojet Rocketdyne company that's been around forever. And they've been building A1 rocket they were actually building it for Boeing. Boeing just wanted to go with another rocket company. You know, going with their Blue Origin. But this one, the AR-1 engine, looks like they've got a contract or a tentative contract with Firefly. And if this all works out, a couple years from now, we're going to be seeing another company besides SpaceX and besides Blue Origin and besides these other named Rocket Lab launching also from American soil. And that's pretty much it. We'll see how that goes. Looking forward to seeing how Firefly does. They stole the name from the series that was on many years ago, Firefly series, all about a space program. Any comments, questions for this part of the tech message? This is WSUN. I've come to the end of the list, so if there's no questions, we'll turn it back to Dick. See if he has any comments or questions. See what he wants to do. K2RIW, this is WS2N for Spaceport.
Yeah, I can tell the precipitation at the site in Glen Oaks is making lots of cracklies that come and go. So your signal periodically got quite noisy, Paul. Periodically, there's mine. I guess we heard some cracklies a little bit on Roy's signal tonight, too. So, I think we're going to give it up for the night. Thank you. I'm going to turn it back over to Roy if he wants to reissue his addresses. And if not, and after that, we'll close down for tonight. AC2GS for any final comments. K2RIW, that'd be good, Roy.
Very good, Dick. I never turned down an opportunity. Once again, if anyone has any mailbag questions that they get on the net, you can email them to me. If you have any space-related questions for Paul, you can email them to me. If you have any questions or topics or subjects or puzzlers or refutations of whatever said, you can email them to me. And it all goes to the same email address, mailbag@, alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Once again, that's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the links to all the things that I mentioned are up and ready, and my website is ac2gs.com. So, once again, a thank you to Dick, a thank you to Paul, a thank you to all that participated tonight, and I wish you a good week, and hope that we all can get together next Sunday and do it all over again. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I'll be going clear.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Paul. Can't you eyes be clear? Bye-bye, you guys. See you next week.
Yeah, I heard the crackling on Roy's signal, but
Eh, not too bad. And let's see, tomorrow night we have the Club Net, or Club Info Net, on its repeater at 8:30. That's it. 73. We'll be back next week. Hopefully with a better signal. Go Tech 73.
Z2GS and 1YDY with question.
Thanks.
Yeah, forgive me. It's been a long time since college chemistry. What's the difference between an element and an element that's considered to be a silicate?
I'm not quite sure in the wording. Elements are fundamental ingredients. You can't have a combination that's an element. So it can be defined as a single atom of a substance. Other elements that are combined with silicon and oxygen and in a complex structure.
All right, so the talcum powder that we were talking about earlier in the evening, which I thought was magnesium, was in fact magnesium silicate. And I was just, I'm assuming then that makes it a compound rather than a molecule, molecule rather than an element.
It's a molecule. It's actually a kind of a crystalline substructure. It's defined as magnesium 3, silicon 4, oxygen 10, hydroxyl 2. So it's a real complicated matrix of different elements aligned in a particular order.
Okay, much more complex than I recalled. But like I said, it's been a long time since college chemistry.
Sure, no problem, Hank.
AC2GS, KD2OGB.
Yes, Craig.
Hello, Roy. Really surprised we actually finished a couple minutes early. Real quick from last week, I want to thank you for giving me a suggestion on what to do to get my last drive visible on my computer. I figured it out a pretty simple way, actually, but I do thank you for that.
You're welcome, Craig. I've spent a lot more time with computers than I have with radios the last 30 years, so I thought I might be able to point you in a good direction. So I'm glad everything worked out for you.
One of these days, I would like to share my whole entire specs and photos with you one of these days. Basically, what I just had to do was, it was showing, but it shrunk down, so I formatted it, threw it on my Mac, added a partition, expanded the volume, erased all of it, and it's back to the way it was. And now it's viewable again. I'm just using a dock station since I don't have any more Mullex cables to connect it directly to the motherboard, so I have to use a dock station until I get custom cables.
Okay, as they say, any port in a storm. What I find happens, not that often, but it's annoying when it does happen, drives get partitioned in particular forms that Windows doesn't immediately recognize. That's why I suggested that you go to the disk management, because usually that's a lower level interpretation, and sometimes it'll just show you a drive that it conceives of as non-formatted but non-accessible, and you can just run format. You could disable all the broken partitions and then just format it into a single partition and then break it into whatever partitions that you want. It's something I've done more than a few times with Windows hard drives.
Very good. And you were getting a little bit noisy there toward the end, but you were perfectly fine all this time. I don't know what's going on. One thing you might be surprised with, which you probably might have heard before, I'm actually running with 4 monitors attached to my tower. Before I had 3, now I have 4, and I do a tremendous amount of multitasking. I have 2 tabs in Chrome open and my music program open, and I'm looking at the statuses of all of my CPU, GPU, and RAM, percentage points on my fourth monitor.
If you have some free time, go over to QRZ, look up AC2GS, and you'll see what my little command control station looks like. I have a large center monitor. I have two side monitors that are oriented in portrait mode. And I have a Lenovo tablet off to the side and an iPad on the other side. And I'm running my software-defined radio, Echo Link, streaming audio to the internet, and checking on the chat room and such. So, I sort of can understand where you are there.
You're in the same boat as me and almost like my brother. Now, I assume, does your computer have some gaming specs in it, but mainly you use it for, like, a lot of processing, like for radio usage or other stuff? Because I use mine for editing purposes and other stuff.
Tend to overdo the multitasking. It's not unusual for me to have 20 web browser tabs and 50 or 60 applications running. I'm using a i9 Intel chip with 16 discrete cores and 64 gigabytes of RAM.
Wow, you've got a ton of firepower in that computer. I have 32 gigs in mine. I upgraded from 8 to 32, and my RAM is 21% full. And my GPU is an MSI GTX 960, and I have an AM4 processor that has 8 cores, 16 threads. So I'm pretty much almost to where you are. I plan eventually on throwing more RAM in to get a little more horsepower, but so far I'm fine.
And ultimately, unless I use Photoshop and such, so that's where the extra memory I find is helpful. I also have multiple network-attached storage systems in my basement that amount to something like 70 terabytes, and I back up everything incrementally nightly.
Seems more than what I do, especially since I just got... I do pretty much monthly backups. I don't try to do everything too crazy, but I at least back stuff up. But almost about the same as mine. But that's pretty much it on my end. I hope to catch you next week. I'll be listening in, and I'll come on for questions or comments for your story. I don't have anything on my mind for next week, so I'll catch you then. AC2GS, KD2OGB, we're clear.
WA2CDO again.
Andy?
Yeah, hi. Just saying hello. I heard you talking to Roy. Hello, Roy, again. Yeah, so, Craig, in regard to what I said, if you need any insulators, if you want to build an antenna, let me know, because I have insulators. I got plenty of them. And I'm not going to use all of them. I got more to use in a lifetime.
It's like you've got an unlimited supply of them. And you'll even help me build it, too? Or am I just probably going to ask Don to help me out?
That's up to you. If you want me to help you, I can. Yeah, we could do that. Also, I was thinking of a magnetic loop, which would be an interesting thing to experiment with. They're not too big, and there's an article in QST on how to build one of those. So, and as I said, you have the source at your fingertips because of where you work. So right there, you can get all the stuff, or most of it, that you need. All right, I'm gonna go. Let me give it to Roy. Hello, Roy, again, quickly.
Again, nice to hear you. They're going to shut down the repeater soon, and the repeater is working in mysterious ways. Craig, every so often you drop down, probably for the same reason that I have background noise. So good talking to you, and please participate next Sunday. I enjoy questions, comments, and general participation.
Sounds good. I'll definitely do that. And Andy, since you've really helped me out a lot for the TechNet, you're also on my list, not just Don and the others that I know. If anybody's unavailable and you're available, I'll definitely hire you for the job. But of course I've got others in mind in case you're unavailable, but I'll definitely come to you first, since you've gotten more experience than I do. All right, let me go, because repeater's about a minute off from shutdown. So, 7-3 to all, and this is KD2O, GB in the group. We'll be clear.
Okay, 73 to both. I'm going to bed. I got to go to work tomorrow. WHCDO.
I used to be told gay schluffin.
And, Haxavea.
Talking about secret languages here.
Well, it's close, right? See you later, WHCDO. I'll call you tomorrow on the phone, Paul. WHCDO.
Very good. Talk to you tomorrow, then. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.